Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update on SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, that Wikipedia is protesting by going dark tonight at midnight for 24 hours. James Losey, a policy analyst with the New America Foundation's Open Technology Initiative, joins us to discuss the dire implications to internet freedom if this bill passes. He has an article at Slate.com, The Internet's Intolerable Acts. Then Michael Hudson joins us. He is the president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends, a Wall Street financial analyst, professor of economics, and an economic advisor to governments worldwide, including Iceland, Latvia, and China. We will discuss the downgrading of a number of European countries and the ongoing euro crisis, as well as Michael Hudson's article in a major German newspaper, Europe's Transition from Social Democracy to Oligarchy. Then finally, with President Obama hosting Jordan's King Abdullah today at the White House, we'll examine why Jordan has not gone the way of other countries as the Arab Spring sweeps the region. The editor of the Middle East Report, Pete Moore, who is a professor of political science at Case Western University, joins us to explain how the kingdom that has the same socioeconomic grievances as Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, and Syria is holding together. And I'm speaking now with James Losey, who is a policy analyst with the New America Foundation's Open Technology Initiative. He writes about user freedoms and the digital divide that has been published in Advances in Computing, Arts Technica, Common Law Conspectus, IEEE Internet Computing, IEEE Spectrum, and Slate. His latest article at Slate is The Internet's Intolerable Acts. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Losey.
Hi, great to be here.
And I'm absolutely puzzled here as to how SOPA got as far as it got in terms of what it's requiring internet providers to do. Just quoting, just reading it briefly from your article in Slate.com, James Losey. The SOPA would create a system of private regulations to shut down websites that are accused of not doing enough to prevent copyright infringement. And these shutdowns would happen before a site owner could defend himself in court, and SOPA could punish sites without even establishing whether they are guilty of the charges brought against them. Is that, on the surface, that's pretty extraordinary. I mean, how is this? No wonder Wikipedia is going dark in protest.
Well, absolutely. I think what happened here is both the Protect IP Act in the Senate, which is being voted on next week, and SOPA in the House, is I think there was a lot of people in Congress that started backing this bill without actually truly realizing what the bill was going to do. I think there was a hearing last month where it came out that a lot of representatives didn't understand the technical issues talked about in the bill. And I think there's a lot of people still grappling with what are the freedom of speech concerns and how is this going to affect human rights online.
So you were on the Hill today, I believe, in Senator Dick Durbin's office. What is where do you think the numbers are in terms of the vote? Because I think it started out under this kind of rubric of you know, we've got to prevent things like child pornography, and that sort of laid the groundwork. And now, with tremendous lobbying from Hollywood and former senator representing Hollywood, the impression is that SOPA's got some wind in its back.
So next week there's going to be a cloture vote on the Protect IP Act, which means there need to be 60 votes in order for the bill to move forward, no longer have an opportunity to filibuster, and move immediately towards amendments and trying to pass the bill. And I think tomorrow there's going to be a tremendous amount of action online. There's going to be Wikipedia is going to be blacking out. I read online that Google is going to be posting information on their front page, which would be unprecedented. And a number of other sites, including Reddit and online communities, are going to have ways for people just online to easily contact their representatives, easily contact their senators, let them know that they're concerned about this legislation. So I think there's going to be a tremendous amount of pushback against the bill tomorrow.
And what was your sense being on the Hill today? Is Chris Dodd winning over his colleagues?
Well, I think a very unfortunate thing here is there seems to be a mentality that this train needs to be moving forward. that there's an opportunity to move forward and fix things at a later date if need be. That's incredibly troubling. One big issue that people have had concerns of is been this DNS filtering component, both in Protect IP, both in SOPA, which is taking a tool out of China's internet censorship toolbox and using the United States to control some types of information online. That finally is being discussed as something that can be taken out. But if it takes that much pressure just to take out an internet censoring component out of a bill without having proper input from engineers, without having debates about it, I think it's very concerning if they're still trying to fix one minor detail and move ahead with a bill that can have troubling implications for free speech online in the U.S.
Again, I'm speaking with James Losey, who's a policy analyst with the New America Foundation's Open Technology Initiative. He has an article at Slate.com, The Internet's Intolerable Acts. And in January of 2010, Hillary Clinton launched the State Department's Internet Freedom Initiative. And now, of course, this SOPA is taking us in the opposite direction and making a mockery of the U.S.'s stand in that regard. Because even though, as you mentioned, they've taken out the Chinese technology that's used to censor the Internet, the Iranians also use this technology, and the Syrian regime is using this technology. Isn't it nevertheless the case that what the government, what this new act will require internet service providers to do is in fact censor, pre-censor anything that goes across their transom?
I mean, I think it's incredibly problematic. I mean, I think the bills and there was several dozen human rights organizations that wrote a letter to Congress saying that the bill sent an unequivocal message to other nations that it's acceptable to censor speech on the global internet. And even without the DNS filtering provisions, there's still other problems with the bills, including the ability for private entities to demand contents taken down without sufficient due process, without sufficient opportunity for other sides to defend themselves and be able to present that they are, in fact, within the law, they are providing useful services, and they are, most importantly, protected speech.
Well, here we're on KPFK in Los Angeles, a Pacifica Public Radio station that was instrumental years ago of invoking the seven words that couldn't be said under the FCC. And since then, the FCC has brought in, under pressure from the Christian right, has made quite draconian fines of any of the seven dirty words are ever spoken on the air. So what we're required to do here is if you have call in and people call in and get a little too boisterous in their language, you have a dump button that you can censor it out. But how's that going to translate to the internet? I just don't understand how it can be done.
Well, now the FCC doesn't have the same authority over the content that's spread on the internet. In order to regulate that. What happens here is there's different proposals of how which entity, including the Attorney General, to be able to take cases to a court and say this is infringing content. But the biggest concern is when you have a private right of action, which means if a copyright holder is able to go to perhaps, say, someone who is a financial revenue of a website, such as an ad service or a payment service, and be able to threaten to sue the payment service over the content of a website that they're providing a service to. When you have that type of regime, when you're leaning on an intermediary like that be responsible for what happens on a website, that's when you start having companies playing cautious and proactively censoring content on the internet, and that is a very troubling prospect.
But no, I wasn't suggesting that the FCC is going to be the policeman in this case. Isn't this act requiring really difficult and draconian self-policing?
Well, that's exactly the case, which is when you have, because the threat would be a financial service would want to make sure that they're not in a position to get sued over what content's on a website they're providing. For example, if there's a blog and there's advertisement on the blog, whatever entities on the overseeing the ad service is going to need to monitor what the blog content is. There's also pressure on the blog operator. Whoever the blog host is potentially depends on how the bills are written in order to monitor what's being posted on the blog, which undermines the free speech potential of the internet.
So this is a struggle between free speech on the internet and anti-piracy, largely coming out of here in Hollywood. Now, do the Hollywood people understand, and they obviously have a point, that their work is being pirated all around the world, and clearly it's affecting revenues here. They're having a terrible year in terms of the box office here in Hollywood, and piracy is rampant. But my understanding...
Well, actually, I want to push back on that. I mean, I would like to see those numbers, because I think the numbers I've seen, the box office in Hollywood has actually done quite well. The numbers that have come out from the Government Accountability Office have shown that jobs in the media creativity industries have actually been doing fairly well. And a lot of the numbers that have been cited in this debate are, in fact, not always citable. And if they are found out, they're not always as factual as you might hope them to be. In fact, Chris Dodd has claimed that piracy has wiped out the film industries of Spain, Egypt, and Sweden. It doesn't take very much to look into a film like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, a Swedish film that's grossed $100 million worldwide, and see that Sweden has a great film industry. Secondly, the U.S. version of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is being filmed in Sweden. It was filmed in Sweden. So I think some of these numbers are dubious at best.
Well, what I was going to suggest, though, James Losey, is that you know, a lot of this started out with Napster and music piracy. But it seems to me that the problem with Hollywood and the recording and music industry is that, look what Apple did. They came up with iTunes, which is a very successful and workable solution. So it seems to me that that you know, you can't fight technology. You've got to work with technology.
And unfortunately, I think what we've seen is that incumbent industries often try to fight new technologies. We can go back all the way to the days of the piano roll. You can see the times when the MPAA tried to kill the VCR, claiming it was going to destroy Hollywood. In fact, the MPAA chairman went publicly in saying that the VCR is to Hollywood what the Boston Strangler is to a woman at home. It is an outrageously out there statement to make, and they even tried to fight MP3 players, which obviously are the music listening or portability or the portable music device of choice these days. And I think they've given opportunities for Apple to come in and dominate the music sale market. They've given opportunities for Netflix to come in and dominate the online to help dominate the online streaming market. I think they're losing new opportunities by trying to fight new technologies.
Yeah, but the irony is when they tried to stop the VCR, it turned out later that Blockbuster and all these other outlets that rented movie videos after the movie was released in the theater made the studios more money than the release of the movies themselves.
You know, you're absolutely right. Most of the money that the movie industry makes is from downstream content, which means it's not the box office. It's rentals. It's today it's streaming online. It's sales. And I think that if we fight new technology rather than innovating in this country, we're going to continue losing important opportunities to have great ways to see content online and great ways to have legal ways to buy media.
Well, just in closing, James Losey, what was your sense on the Hill today in the Senate? Is this thing going to turn around in spite of their colleague Chris Dodd's persuasions?
You know, I think a lot's going to happen tomorrow. I'm really excited to see how much overwhelming support the internet users across the internet are willing to show tomorrow, from Wikipedia to Reddit to even an entity as large as Google, willing to change their pages or even block them out to raise awareness of this bill. And I think if enough calls come in tomorrow, there's going to be a lot of pressure to senators not to vote on this bill.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, James Losey.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with James Losey. He's a policy analyst with the New America Foundation's Open Technology Initiative. He writes about user freedoms and the digital divide and has been published in Advances in Computing, Ars Technica, Common Law Conspectus, IEEE Internet Computing, IEEE Spectrum, and Slate, where his latest article at slate.com is The Internet's Intolerable Acts. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how, according to our next guest, Europe is going from social democracy to oligarchy. 100%. Don't get error. Be careful with the downloading. Protect your eyes. Protect yourself from digital decay. Digital decay. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Hudson, the president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends, a Wall Street financial analyst, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and author of Super Imperialism, The Economic Strategy of American Empire, Trade, Development, and Foreign Debt, and The Myth of Aid. Michael acts as an economic advisor to governments worldwide, including Iceland, Latvia, and China, on finance and tax laws. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Hudson.
Thank you very much.
And you have an article in the German paper, Frankfurter Zeitung, Europe's Transition from Social Democracy to Oligarchy. And frankly, I've been puzzled for some time over the last couple of years interviewing economists about what's happening in Europe and the apparent inability of the Europeans to get their hands around the euro crisis. The more they delay and waffle, the higher the price of bailouts become. And the economist Rob Johnson pointed out to me that there may be another agenda here, and that is that members of the European elite want to break the social contracts, the social democracy in Europe, in order to be more competitive in this new globalized economy. So just as we in America are becoming more like Bangladesh, the hope amongst the European elite is that their workers will become more like Bangladesh. And it's a long question, I know, but now your new article reinforces that.
Well, I think that Rob Johnson is correct. There is a big neoliberal push in Europe. What is so surprising is that it's the socialist parties, the social democrats, and the labor parties that are leading the anti-labor move to the far right of the political spectrum. It's the labor parties and the social democrats that are standing up for the banks and insisting that taxes be levied much more highly on labor to pay the banks. And this is turns upside down everything that social democracy and the labor party stood for a century ago. The situation is by far the worst in Iceland, where they had a labor and green prime minister that is enforced such stringent reduction in living standards, such an awful giveaway to the vulture banks, that 10% of the Icelandic population have had to emigrate to live in Norway and other countries because there's no work. In Germany and in Greece, it was the Socialist Party that led the movement to the far right, saying we have to cut wages by 50%. It was the conservatives that opposed this. It was the socialists. In fact, the Greek president is the president of the Socialist International, who said we've got to pay the banks by taking it out of labor. We cannot tax the rich. We cannot tax property. We cannot tax land. We must reduce wages. And this is hard for foreign observers to realize. And you have very much the same situation in the post-Soviet economies. So all of the concepts of right and left of the political spectrum has been turned upside down by the fact that the left wing supports the banks and is the most neoliberal, the most anti-labor of all. They're almost as anti-labor as Obama and the Democrats are in the United States.
Well, it was the Democrats, after all, who voted for the TARP bailout, and the Republicans didn't. You recall the first vote went down, and the financial establishment and the Treasury Secretary and then President Bush and Nancy Pelosi all panicked and managed to persuade everybody on the second TARP vote to give away all this money to Wall Street. So arguably what you're describing in Europe also exists here. But my understanding about Iceland was that, first of all, it was the British and the Dutch banks that opened amazing amounts of accounts in Iceland, which were far exceeded the number of people, mostly British depositors and Dutch depositors. That whole thing was so absurd from the surface. That was the beginning of the unraveling, wasn't it?
In a way, yes, but the British depositors and Dutch had their deposits in British banks and Dutch banks that happened to be owned by Icelanders in conjunction with Russian criminals and other sort of underworld figures. So it's a myth that the Icelandic people were in any way liable to bail out Copthing and Icesave and these banks. These are pretty purely British banks And Gordon Brown was trying to cover his own incompetence and the incompetence of the British Financial Services Agency by trying to blame the Icelanders. What's much worse is that after the Icelandic banks went bankrupt, they were sold to a group of vulture bankers, including apparently the owners of the earlier banks, for about 10 cents on the dollar. And the agreement was that the buyers of these banks would scale down the bad real estate loans and other loans by 90% also to the same proportion. They haven't done that, and the Social Democratic and Green government says that's okay. Not only do they say that the vulture banks can collect the full amount, and this is for a country that's in much more negative equity here, but Iceland has a indexation of the bank loan, the principal, and the interest to the consumer price index, which means the foreign exchange rate. Now, this is illegal under the Constitution, but the government, the socialist government, has retroactively said, well, we're changing the laws so that the vulture banks can get paid even more. This has led to the government there having only an 8% approval rating. It's even lower than Obama's here. Yet they're saying, we're in power, we're not going to give up. We're here to give, essentially, our backers, the banks, everything they want. And Iceland was viewed as a kind of test case, along with Latvia, that led the Europeans to think, well, wait a minute, if we can cut their GDP by 30%, if we can cut their wages by 50%, and in Latvia, if we can cut the public sector wages by 30% and essentially shift the tax on the labor off property, why can't we do it throughout all of Europe, Greece, Spain, Italy? And so the class war is back in business, but in this case, the class war against labor is being led by the left-wing parties. And there doesn't seem to be any solution to this. You wouldn't expect the Republicans here to really stand up against other banks. They voted against TARP only when they saw that the Democrats were voting so strongly for it that they could make a populist pretense at opposing the banks. But if it really would have been important to pass the law, you can be sure the Republicans would have jumped on board just as badly as the Democrats
sure.
did, because they know where their campaign funding is coming
from. Well, but they were much, tactically and politically, they were much cleverer, because out of that was born the Tea Party, where the right captured outrage over Wall Street instead of the left, who should have owned that issue. Again, I'm speaking with Michael Hudson, the president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends. He's a Wall Street financial analyst and professor of economics. Your article in the Frankfurter Zeitung, Europe's Transition from Social Democracy to Oligarchy. By the way, isn't that a Christian Democratic newspaper?
Yes.
That's Merkel's party.
Yes, and you can see that within the Christian Democratic Party, well, first of all, this is the largest newspaper in Germany. It's one of the Germany has only two national papers, and this is one of them, and this is the mainstream conservative paper. And what this shows is that even within the Christian Democrats and the center parties there, there's a reaction against neoliberalism. And the neoliberals are now mainly on the left wing of the spectrum. And the conservatives are saying, wait a minute, this is going to, it's all very well to increase profits and investment, but if we bankrupt the consumers, there's not going to be anybody to buy what we're producing, and it's suicidal.
Well, it has echoes of your article and what you reveal, Michael Hudson, has echoes of Naomi Klein's shock doctrine, crisis capitalism. You say, under the political umbrella of financial emergency, wages and living standards are to be scaled back and political power shifted from elected governments to technocrats governing on behalf of large banks and financial institutions. Public sector labor is to be privatized and deunionized, while Social Security, pension plans and health insurance are scaled back. Now, the big difference, of course, between the Europeans and the Americans is that the Europeans actually have a social safety net. They have full health care, pregnancy leave, childcare, you name it. We have very little. What we have here, Social Security, Medicare, the Republicans are trying to dismantle. My understanding, though, is, and it's pathetic over here to think that the debates that are going on now, with the, in particular in South Carolina, with the Republicans and their campaign, will be against healthcare. In this country, you can actually successfully argue against healthcare. It's an extraordinary difference. But in Europe, whenever the governments threaten their social safety net, the people take to the streets. So what's not happening?
I don't think people here have any idea what's in store for them. And that's why I focus so much on Latvia and Iceland as dress rehearsals for what's going to happen here as well as in Europe. The basic financial position is you don't know how far you can push wages and living standards down until people push back. And nobody's pushing back here. At least when the Greeks all went out in the general strike, that showed that no matter what the government agreed to pay Europe, that the agreement was not made with democratic approval. And that means that when another government comes in, presumably the conservative government, which over the weekend said that it was not going to go along with the austerity program and would not go along with the privatization sell-off, that means only the socialists want to privatize. Only the socialists want to reduce labor. That means that when they come in, they will say, this debt is an odious debt. It was done by bribery or whatever, but the government that signed the debt did not represent the Greek people. You Europeans could all turn on your television and you could see the demonstrators in the street saying, we oppose this. Same thing in Spain, same thing in Italy. You have in the wings the conservative parties waiting to come in and repudiate the debts. Who would have thought?
Well, Michael Hudson, just in today's news, of course, is somewhat perplexing. You know, just recently, the third rating agency, Standard & Poor's, downgraded a lot of European debt, except for the Germans, the French, the Dutch, the Austrians. Austria, of course, is owed an enormous amount of money by Hungary. The Dutch, of course, that's a big surprise. Yet the financial news today indicates that all European stocks are up. So explain that.
I can't explain why the stock market is going up, except that there's so much money around that nowhere else to go. The stock market, the effect of Standard & Poor's downgrading. First of all, Standard & Poor is on an ultra-right-wing Tea Party ideology. They are trying to downgrade governments to force governments essentially to take a right-wing policy. When they downgrade, this means that institutional investors, such as pension funds and mutual funds, are legally not allowed to hold the debt of these countries. Now, if you have billions of dollars of funds invested in government bonds that are downgraded, this money has to be invested somewhere else. And so I think they're going to shift out of the bond market into the stock market, which would explain why the stock market has gone up today. Meanwhile, this has lowered the price of bonds, letting vulture funds, who are the main backers of the rating agencies here, letting vulture funds come in and grab bonds at a discount to come in later and demand austerity. So what you're doing is you're having economic and financial policy pass out of the hands of elected representatives into the hands of the bankers. And what they call a free market is centralized planning in the hands of bankers. The key thing to realize is that the people who talk about the free market want a much more centralized economy, even than Stalinism. But they want to centralize the economy in the hands of the banks and the 1% of the population, not in the form of government. And they fight government because that's the only power that's able to regulate and tax them. So the free marketers are the hyper-centralizers politically of our day. That was the aim of the article that I wrote, which is, by the way, in English, it's on my website, michael-hudson.com.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Hudson, the president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends. He's also a Wall Street financial analyst, a professor of economics, and an advisor to governments worldwide, including Iceland, Latvia, and China on finance and tax laws. Of course, the US, I think, started this other trend, which is the transfer of private debt into public debt. That's what happened in 2008, where the profligacy and recklessness of Wall Street ended up, the taxpayer ended up having to bail them out. And I think it's the record amount of private debt that was turned into public debt. The Levy Institute did a study saying that the Fed put up $29 trillion to stabilize the Wall Street and the global economy.
They're counting all the transactions.
Sure.
Randy Ray, who did that calculation.
Right.
And he's a colleague of mine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He added up, what happened was the Fed refused to say how much money it had actually printed and given to the bank. So Bloomberg Financial, that the mayor of New York controls, brought a lawsuit to find out. And Randy added up the sum of all of the debts that were made. All of the bonds and junk securities that were taken onto the Fed's balance sheet, and that was $29 billion. But many of these were refinancings, and I think the net was about $13 trillion. So, in effect, claiming to fight the government spending and fighting the government debt, you had the neoliberals, the free marketers, vastly increase the government debt as they did under Reagan.
So whether it was $29 trillion or $13 trillion, it's still, compared to what the European Central Bank has put up to rescue the euro and shore up the bond market attacking sovereign debt, it's pathetic. It's about $1 trillion, isn't it?
What do you mean? It's all
well, in other words, they don't have a Federal Reserve in Europe at any rate, but my understanding...
That's right. They're not able to. The bank succeeded in blocking governments from financing themselves and doing what a central bank is supposed to do, from the Bank of England to the Federal Reserve here. They say, no, the governments have to pay us interest for creating credit on our computer keyboards that the government could do just as well on its computer keyboards. So they've said the hallmark of democracy is oligarchy, basically. The hallmark of democracy is taking the central banks out of the hands of elected officials and making them independent. By independent, they mean controlled by the commercial bank lobbyists. So it's we're dealing with a kind of Orwellian rhetoric here. That is just the opposite of, you know, what basic economic and political reality is.
But you mentioned a little while ago, Michael Hudson, the right-wing Tea Party mentality, and my understanding is that there's a fear that right-wing parties will be revived in Europe, and it's already happened in Hungary, where you have under Orbán.
Well, they already have been revived. The Labour Party in England is more right-wing than almost any other party. The Labour Party in Greece is
right.
Right-wing.
But nobody's
the Socialist Party is way to the right. These are the right-wing parties.
No, but. Believe you me, the Orbán's party in Hungary is a fascist party. Their government-endorsed thugs are running around the streets beating up gypsies and gays. The European Union has had to try and stop them from their taking over these repressive press laws. Now they're trying to take over the judiciary and all the finance institutions through the ruling party, which got a two-thirds majority. I mean, it's happening there. That has echoes of 1930 in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
So is that a possibility that you know? I'm trying to get a distinction here between right wing bankers and what happens
the right wing fascism is coming from the left wing of the spectrum in Europe. It'll be called it's the socialist parties that are leading the ultra right anti labor. Pro-bank movement. That's the purpose of my article. That's what's so hard to understand. How on earth did it happen? How could someone like Tony Blair or Gordon Brown ever be elected as Labour Party instead of ultra-right wingers in England? How could someone like the Icelandic right-winger ever be elected as a Social Democrat? How could the Papandreou in Greece ever be elected as a socialist when he's on the far right of the political spectrum? We're talking about national socialists here.
Which, of course, was the manner under which Hitler emerged.
Yes, indeed.
So just in closing then, Michael Hudson, my understanding was that much of the debate had been sort of racialized along a north-south divide, that the Germans were basically thinking that, you know, saying that the Greeks and the Spaniards and the Portuguese, et cetera, were a bunch of lazy people who didn't pay their taxes, whereas we frugal tax-paying Germans are having to foot the bill. My understanding is that
That's what the Americans say the Germans are saying. I haven't heard any Germans saying that at all.
I see.
The Germans are smart enough to look at the statistics. They know that under the UN statistics and the European government statistics, the Greeks work very, very hard. No one has said the Greeks are lazy. This is only what the American press say that the Germans say, because they don't like the Germans. But this is American anti-German racism. This is despicable. The Germans do not say this. There's no trace at all of any kind of racism there.
But Germany has clearly benefited from the euro. It's created enormous export markets for them in Europe. Isn't it pretty clear that they are resisting bailing out their southern euro partners?
Sure. Because no politician is in a position to tax its own population to support the failure of other governments to tax their rich. And the problem in Greece is there's a huge tax evasion. The Greeks were dominated by the colonels for many years that were supported by the Americans as anti-communists. And ever since, they've had essentially a very regressive tax system that taxes labor but not the rich. And there's massive tax evasion. There's supposedly 45 billion euros of Greek flight capital in Switzerland, and the European banks are asking the Greek government to sell off 50 billion euros of public property to subsidize the capital flight. And of course, that's really what it is. The criticism is over the Greek government's corruption and the inability to tax the rich. And if you don't tax the rich, if you don't have progressive taxation, you're going to have a huge budget deficit. And if you don't have a central bank to fund the government deficit, then you're going to have to tax the people. And neither Germany nor any other country in Europe is willing or can be elected if it says, well, we're going to raise taxes on you Germans to subsidize the Greek oligarchy's ability to avoid paying taxes itself. Their position is very understandable. The problem is that there's no central bank in Europe, and there's no overall tax system, and nobody's really talked about shifting the taxes back onto real estate and property, except in Greece. In Greece, they're saying, look, we've got to tax the land, because you can't hide that. We've got to go back to taxing visible wealth, not invisible wealth. And the rest of Europe is not pressing for this, so they're not helping Greece at all put its its government budget in a position to be able to pay the debt. So nobody has any scenario except for default in a month or two from Greece.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Michael Hudson.
Okay, thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Hudson, who's the president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends. He's a Wall Street financial analyst and professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and author of Super Imperialism, The Economic Strategy of American Empire, Trade, Development, and Foreign Debt, and The Myth of Aid. Michael acts as an economic advisor to governments worldwide, including Iceland, Latvia, and China, on finance and tax laws. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how come the Kingdom of Jordan has avoided the Arab Spring so far.
wash back, but I'm only going over Jordan.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Pete Moore, professor of political science at Case Western University and editor of the Middle East Report. He is a senior research fellow with the Inter-University Consortium for Arab and Middle East Studies based in Montreal and has published on issues of political economy and trade politics in the Middle East, including doing business in the Middle East, politics and economic crisis in Jordan and Kuwait. Welcome to Background Briefing, Pete Moore.
Thank you.
And with the Jordanian King Abdullah's visit to the White House today, my understanding is that a lot of the negotiations are really about Jordan hosting the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, which the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has demanded an Israeli settlement freeze before talks begin on January the 25th, which is quite soon. The Israelis don't agree with that date. Is that your understanding of what these meetings are about?
Yes, primarily Jordan, from the from Washington's perspective, is being asked to kickstart the peace process. For its part, the Jordanian monarchy is doing what it normally does when it comes to Washington, which is to ask for economic, budgetary, and military support at a crucial time in the region.
But that's been going on for some time, hasn't it? Jordan has essentially been supported by the U.S. since its beginning.
Oh, sure, sure. But the idea is that as Jordan usually plays this role in the peace process, the regime looks for payback, usually in economic and military support. And given the events in Syria, given the increased tensions in the Gulf, you know, it can be expected that the Jordanian regime is going to ask for more support.
So how does King Abdullah juggle the fact that he's negotiating with the Israelis, who, needless to say, are very unpopular in the Arab world? The Arab Spring is sweeping the region, and right next door in Syria, you have close to a civil war going on. And his country is, what, 60% Palestinian, living in camps, who don't have the same rights as Jordanians?
Well, not all, not the majority of Palestinians still live in the refugee camps. But yes, it is. Jordan is a divided society, and this has been a constant theme in its history, constantly, the regime, the monarchy, constantly balancing sort of internal pressures with trying to align itself with external patrons. And so the strategy has been rather simple. Domestically, the idea is divide and rule, keep the opposition, off balance, and then externally solidify support originally from the British and today currently from Washington to get monetary and budgetary support to keep this kind of divide and rule type of strategy going. And it's worked for a long time. But like Tunisia and Egypt and Yemen, many of the same grievances that led to mass political protests there are in place in Jordan. It's just that the Jordanian regime has enjoyed significantly more external support, and the opposition is much more divided than it was in Egypt and Tunisia.
And how much did the Iraq war impact Jordan? Because clearly the winner of the Iraq war is Iran, and there's an Iranian a government very sympathetic to Iran in place there now. The Sunni, a lot of the Sunni retreated into Jordan, I believe, during the civil war there, and they're not too happy about what's happened to their country, Iraq. Is that another sort of seething element in this mix?
Sure. Ever since really the late 70s, early 80s, there's been a close economic and sort of political alliance with the regime in Baghdad to the benefit of the Hashemite monarchy. And having that regime go away is, has been a big disruption in Jordanian political and social life. It adds to sort of the pressure on Jordan economically and socially. But also it suggests, you know, in terms of the uprising and the ability for there to be mass mobilized opposition, you know, the regime in Jordan can point to what's happened in Iraq in terms of the civil war, can point to what's happening in Syria, and you know, suggest to the Jordanian public, look, if you want political opposition, this is where it might go if you demand real voice. So the events in Iraq and then what's unfolding in Syria is deeply disturbing to Jordanian society and politics.
And, of course, the Assad family clan who are holding on to Syria, you know, to the last, murdering the last Syrian to do so, they've used this, implicitly used the same argument about what happened in Iraq, right?
Oh, sure, right. And, I mean, in relations, of course, between Jordan and Syria are not at all good, and King Abdullah was the first Arab leader to come out and openly state that Assad, you know, should step down. So, you know, the instability in Syria has potentials for spreading into Jordan, but at least in the short term, the importance to Jordan is sort of that negative example of what might happen if there's real political voice in Jordan. Again, this is sort of the argument from the regime to handicap the opposition.
Again, I'm speaking with Pete Morris, professor of political science at Case Western University, the editor of the Middle East Report, where he has an article, Doing Business in the Middle East, Politics and Economic Crisis in Jordan and Kuwait. Now, Jordan reneged on its 1999 decision to expel Hamas, recently the Jordanian Prime Minister affirmed that Hamas members would be welcome back to Jordan following their expulsion from Syria as long as they refrained from engaging in political activity. And of course, Hamas is now pretty much, you know, its origins were in the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. Now they pretty much ditched the Syrians and embraced this new Egypt. And Jordan, of course, has its own equivalent of the Muslim Brotherhood called the Islamic Action Front. Where do things stand in that regard?
Well, just quickly, the Islamic Action Front is much different than Hamas. I mean, they're similar in terms of being sort of offshoots of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood many years ago, and they share some sort of general ideological commitments, but as in terms of political entities, they're very different. The Islamic Action Front in Jordan has generally worked closely with the monarchy and co-opted by the monarchy, been something of a loyal opposition. Yes, you know, it is true that the Hashemites have offered to bring Hamas back in to Jordan. it's unclear why. Except to the extent that if this allows the Americans and the Jordanian intelligence to watch Hamas more closely than would be the case if Hamas was still in Damascus. That's probably not lost on leaders in the movement. But again, I think this is expressive of this role that King Abdullah has tried to play in being an intermediary, or really not really an intermediary, but a tool of American sort of interest when it comes to the peace process. So sort of reining in Hamas or watching it more closely would be part of this, you know, this strategy of sort of containing the peace process in a sense, being able to have influence with all of the actors.
And Pete Moore, the Israeli right have always had what they call the Jordanian option, which calls for the expulsion or relocation of Palestinians into Jordan, arguing that Jordan's already has a huge Palestinian population. These peace talks that presumably President Obama and Jordan's King Abdullah are talking about today at the White House, they can't even agree on when they start, and the Palestinians are demanding an Israeli settlement freeze before they start. Nobody much thinks they've got much of a chance of taking place. We could be surprised, of course. Where does the Jordanian option stand, given that Netanyahu's a fairly right-wing Israeli prime minister, and his foreign minister, of course, Avigdor Lieberman, is even more so?
Yeah, that's not really a palatable or moral choice. I mean, that's a form of ethnic cleansing, and One would have to imagine the forced expulsion of hundreds of thousands of people, millions, in fact, and then Jordanian authorities allowing that to occur. That's really outside the bounds. I think it's used by some groups in Israel sort of as a means to, make the peace process more difficult. But as Jordan stands in the middle of this, again, the Jordanian regime and authorities have not very much leeway in the positions that they can adopt in the peace process. And I think as you rightly state, there's not much real belief that anything's going on, that this is more of a rhetorical exercise, that really on the ground, when we're talking about in the West Bank and Gaza, nothing's really changed, either in terms of the power dynamics or in terms of the occupation. And so much of what's going on in Washington or Amman or Tel Aviv is sort of aimed at a different audience, and it's not really constitutive of a real peace process. And so in that sense, Jordan is part of a larger political play that's going on. But as far as real change on the ground, it's not very effectual.
But just given that this is a kingdom largely supported by the U.S. taxpayers, etc., has been for some time, again, I'm just in closing, how does King Abdullah do it? Because he doesn't even speak good Arabic, I'm told. I don't know whether that's true or not, but
right. No, that was one of the early criticisms among a number of sort of superficial criticisms about Abdullah. I think we can't underestimate fear. Fear has been a motivating factor in politics for a long time, and it's been at play in the region, just as it has in many parts of the world. And Jordanian public is divided in a lot of ways. There are supporters of the Hashemites. The Hashemites have made a number of people, although a very small number of people, very wealthy, both in Jordan and outside the country. They serve interests primarily of the United States, which brings a lot of support. So on the one hand, the regime has been smart. They've been able to co-opt a small number of people who are politically important in the country, and they've done the right thing externally to earn them, a great deal of money. But on the other hand, Jordanians are fearful. There was a civil war, although it was short-lived in 1970. Mm-hmm. The older generation remembers that, and the younger generation can look across the border. As we said earlier, in Iraq, look at what's happening in Syria. And it's easy to scare people. So,
well, Pete Morrow, I thank you for joining us. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I appreciate your filling us in on what's happening in Jordan.
Great. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Pete Morrow, Professor of Political Science at Case Western University and editor of the Middle East Report. He's also a senior research fellow and author of Doing Business in the Middle East, Politics and Economic Crisis in Jordan and Kuwait. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began talking about SOPA, which is the Stop Online Piracy Act. Wikipedia is protesting. They're going dark tonight at midnight for 24 hours. Others, Google, Reddit are protesting as well. I talked to James Losey, a policy analyst with the New America Foundation's Open Technology Initiative. He'd been on Capitol Hill all day, meeting with a lot of senators, including Dick Durbin, who's key to it. Of course, the Hollywood people who are pushing SOPA, their lobby, the MPAA, have a former senator there on Capitol Hill who is doing his best to carry water and pass this bill. The good news is a lot of the congressmen and the senators are learning for the first time some of the terrible stuff in the bill. For example, they're requiring internet service providers to use the same technology the Chinese use to censor their internet and the Syrians use to look for dissidents and kill them. In other words, you have to give up the names of the people who are using your system. So Senator Chris Dodd, of course, is doing his best on behalf of Hollywood, but Hollywood is brain dead. I mean, they opposed the VCR, and then that turned around and they found out that they made more money out of renting VCRs than they made out of releasing films in the first place. So the agreement was that the problem with SOPA is that the people who are calling for it just don't have the imagination to deal with new technology, as, for example, Apple has done with iTunes. So hopefully it won't pass, but it will require people making a lot of noise to stop it. And then we talked with Michael Hudson, who is an advisor to a number of countries, including Iceland, Latvia, and China, in Economist. He has an article in the big German newspaper, which is basically the paper of Angela Merkel's party, the Christian Democrats. The article is Europe's Transition from Social Democracy to Oligarchy. I wanted to talk to him about what's behind, why can't the Europeans get their hands around this euro crisis? And it's been puzzling me for some time. Rob Johnson, a very distinguished economist, suggested the European elite wanted to break the social contracts, just like the Republicans here want to break the social contracts and turn us all into Sri Lankans and Bangladeshis to compete in the global labor market. He said that is that is in play. He took it a lot further. He blames the neoliberals, the socialist governments. He said they're even worse than the conservative governments in terms of selling out their own people. So very interesting and provocative interview, I thought. And then finally, we talked about what's happening at the White House today with Jordan King's Abdullah's visit. I talked with a professor of political science at Case Western, Pete Moore, as a specialist on Jordan. And the real question is, how come Jordan's escaped the Arab Spring? And how come this kingdom with 60% of the population, the Palestinians, how do they hold on to power? And he answered it largely because they looked at what happened next door in Iraq and they don't want it to happen there. But they are trying to broker deals with the Palestinians, which of course are going nowhere. And the Israeli right have this dream of pushing all the Palestinians out into Jordan and that, thus becoming a de facto Palestinian state. But he seemed to think that the kingdom would survive, which is in itself pretty amazing. Again, I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.